Thank you.
All right, on to item six, review of report on growth sub-portfolio. Tim.
So I want to walk through the composition, the role of growth sub-portfolio, and touch on a few moving pieces that I think should the board should be focused on here. Just a reminder, under our current way of operating the asset pool, we do these annual deep dives. So the liquidity, growth, and diversifying all get a dedicated review. We did the liquidity a couple months ago. We have the growth today. Diversifying will come up before the end of the year. But this is just a chance to get into the details of how we've structured each program, how they're working, areas of strength, areas of concern, and remind the trustees what the big moving pieces are and the rationale for how we structured them the way we did. So I want to step in here and just really focus on what growth does inside the SACERA framework, how we define it, what goes into that, what the asset classes are that are included in that heading. The composition of the program, obviously, talked about where we are in the funding process of getting up to the long-term targets. Touch on some of the recent big moving pieces. We've had a program that was largely growth allocated historically. We're in the process of changing that. We've got two big moving pieces that have been put in place to date, and a third that's going to be talked about later on today's agenda. And then just touch on some strategic decisions that the board makes along the way here as well. So if you turn to slide three, and we have got that nice visual image that I use over and over again because I like the colors more than anything else. Growth is really, this is the heart of the program. This is not necessarily the operational heart, but this is the long-term sustainability piece. This provides all the heavy lifting. It provides the vast majority of long-term rates of return. So this is where we can think about future liabilities will be funded by the growth of this portfolio largely. This is something, anybody who is an active member now, such as myself, where, my retirement payments won't start for 20, 25, 30 years, this is what I'm looking for in terms of offsetting my future liability payments. And then the diversifying is really the hedge against that. It allows us to maintain that growth allocation. And we'll talk about why we think about growth as a unique asset class and why we kind of treat it with a little bit different set of rules around how we want to trade in and out of it here. But really just think about that. This is future liabilities invested here. If you take a look at slide four, there's a snapshot of where we're at here. We've talked to you on an annual basis about where we recommend allocating these growth assets and all assets really. And you'll recall that we have a long-term target of drawing down domestic equities quite significantly. We recognize that is a process because where we're migrating to is largely private markets and a couple of other asset classes where we had to conduct searches, one of which we'll touch on later today. But you can kind of see the snapshot of where we're at there. The domestic equity is down to about 11% in the current target allocation. That's down significantly from where we were 5 or 6 years ago. And it's on a glide path down to about 5% right now. So we're migrating the listed equities from the U.S. to non-U.S., and that's based upon relative valuations. Those move from year to year, so we review them year to year to see if that thesis is still in place. And we've made a concerted decision here at the board to say some of the private market allocations are more attractive to us, private equity, private real estate, private credit. Again, we're going to review some of that today. So we're tilting in that direction. Those are the ones that take a long period of time. The biggest moving piece we have left is private credit, which Stepstone will be here later today to review our progress on that. We're about 2.5 years away from getting to it, closer to our target allocation there. So slide five, we talk about how we measure this and how we think about the growth allocation. Because we are thinking about this in terms of something to provide that heavy lift for funding future liabilities, we have a focus on achieving absolute returns here. Risk is a consideration, absolutely. We're looking for risk-adjusted returns. We're looking for efficiency. But the biggest piece we look for is where do we see the chance to expand our capital on the horizon? And then we'll accept the volatility that comes along with that and insulate that a bit. So really it's that absolute return is our focus number one, the risk we accept. to achieve that absolute return is number two, and that goes into a lot of the decision-making process I just touched on to go into emerging markets, into the private markets, et cetera. And these are on the right-hand side here, the objectives and the measurements. This is what shows up in the staff report on a quarterly basis. This is how we staff report out on our progress to the board. So slides 6 through 8 are going to talk a little bit about why we think about growth as a group and why we treat it differently. If you take a look at slide 6, you can see in our current portfolio is on the left, our long-term target is on the right. Growth assets collectively, so we're talking everything from equities to private markets to real estate to high yield, anything that benefits from global economic growth, and that benefit shows up primarily from a capital appreciation, we collectively put those together because we view those as somewhat interchangeable. So in the current portfolio, that's about 71%, long-term 67%, so two-thirds of our program allocated to these assets today and for the foreseeable future. So great, two-thirds of our assets, so it's two-thirds of what we should keep an eye on, right? Well, we turn to slide 7. And what do we think about in terms of that secondary consideration of risk? Almost all the risk on a forward-looking basis from in the portfolio, and when we say risk, we're talking standard deviation and volatility. I know Gabe's going to ask me what I mean by risk. So almost all of the volatility comes from this exposure. So the year-to-year variability, which has been very low over the past decade since the global financial crisis with financial accommodation in the marketplace, has led to lower than historical volatility in stocks and similar assets. But on a forward-looking basis, virtually all the risk is coming here. Now, okay, great. Is that something we just accept to move on? Well, we want to think about this a little bit differently under the Cicera asset allocation framework. Say, we don't want to be forced sellers or forced traders of our growth portfolio, which is why we paired it with liquidity to handle all the operational cash flows and handle 4 years of benefit payments, and diversifying to say, if the equity market draws back, if these growth assets draw down, we recognize that there will be volatility here. We're starting to see that pick up again in 2018. We can draw from the diversifying pool to fund back into this. So we don't necessarily need to draw from the liquidity pool here. So liquidity, all operational pieces, growth, long-term expansion with short-term noise, diversifying allows us to buy the dips in the growth portfolio. And that's really what we touch on slide 8 there, is really some roles of each individual program. And I think, importantly, some of the nomenclature can get confusing, and some of the times we talk about why we're different. It's really the growth. We recognize we need it. We recognize that it comes with the volatility, so we pair it with the other asset classes so all of our short-term liquidity needs are met. So if we're coming in here and talking about trading in and out of the growth portfolio on a frequent basis, we got somewhat of an issue. We want to trade in this infrequently and just do rebalancing to buy the dips for the most part and trim at peaks. So the typical rebalancing, not for short-term needs.
Quick question. So how many investment managers do we have prior to FFP? How many do we have now? What is our goal?
The exact numbers,
just roughly.
60 was our going in count. We reduced public markets a bit, but we'll expand private markets. So coming out of this, we're probably going to be looking at closer to 75 line items.
Okay, so we're going to go from 60 to 75 when we get to our ultimate goal.
Yeah, but when I say 75, it's we'll have fewer public market managers and we'll have a broader portfolio of private market managers.
Okay.
And that comes largely from migrating away from fund to funds, where there would be 20 underlying
right.
funds, and we'll be selecting the best 4 of those.
Gotcha.
So our actual exposure to be a fewer numbers, but in terms of line items you see in the report, it will expand. But we just the fund to funds are going to go to directs.
Yeah. So you'll be managing more. I mean, I think it's a good idea that you just be managing more internally than.
We'll be overseeing more internally.
Right.
Yeah. And that's largely why we've made the decision to hire Stepstone to help us in the oversight of that. Verus is obviously here to help in the oversight of the big picture analysis there as well. So I think we think of these things in terms of building blocks. So where can we express a view, find a manager who's aligned with that view, and use them as a building block to something greater? So we view it as, yeah, there will be 75 building blocks. Think of them as Legos. Some will be tiny little Legos, and some will be big old Duplos in the public markets. Yeah.
They all fit together.
Yes, I have two children under the age of 10, so I think in Legos. Slide 9, we talk about performance, and you've seen this before in the last staff report, but just a reminder in terms of how we think about, is it working? So we're measuring absolute returns. We're seeing that absolute five-year return of 9.6%. We say, like, that's on track. We're getting high single-digit returns from this, and so that's providing the big heavy lift on the growth side. Return above a benchmark, well, we said we did outperform the benchmark that we choose here, which is a global equity index, but not by as much as we would have liked to have. But then we say the excess return comes with a different risk profile as well. What do we earn per unit of risk deployed? Well, we earned 1.6 units of risk, or 1.6 units of return per unit of risk deployed, and the benchmark was 0.9. So we more efficiently deploy capital than just a broad equity implementation. So largely speaking, we're on track there. Now, we also have to caveat that and say we began this implementation process of the current incarnation of growth about 2 years ago. So we're about 2 years into this. So part of this five-year number here includes how we were positioned previously and part of how we're going, part of where we're heading here. So maybe we turn to slide 10. We can talk about the recent decisions and our pathway to getting fully implemented. We have, as I mentioned earlier, we've historically had a growth-oriented portfolio, and that made perfect sense when contributions were going to be relatively high relative to our expenditures on, relative to our benefit payments. As we become a mature plan and those even out, and as we go to a slightly even more mature plan where benefit payments are larger than contributions coming in, we need to restructure, and that's what drove the entire conversation here. So we are largely starting down a path of ratcheting down our overall growth exposure, increasing our overall diversifying and liquidity exposure. We're still early innings on that process, though. Made the strategic decision to reduce that overweight in 2016 as part of the new asset allocation structure. Immediately increase the illiquid asset class targets, but recognize that there needs to be a pathway to get ramped up in private equity and private credit and real estate, and we are in the midst of that now. And tilted the allocation towards non-US. The big moving piece there was we brought in a dedicated emerging market. We had had dedicated emerging markets years ago as in part of a broader exposure with one manager, but this is the first time in our history where we've really had a large dedicated emerging markets exposure.
And that's non-public emerging markets exposure.
That's publicly listed emerging markets.
Is it all public or some private?
Today, it's all public.
Okay.
On a dedicated basis. We'll have individual positions in emerging markets within the private portfolio, but there'd be very, very few and far between. Think of the private markets as overwhelmingly domestic focused. The listed equities we've tilted towards non-US and emerging markets. So I want to touch base on emerging markets, private credit, and risk parity, because to me these are the three big changes in the growth portfolio, and I just want to reiterate what the rationale was and where our progress is right now. So slide 11, we talk about the emerging markets. I did mention it was approved in 2016. We conducted the searches. The latter half of 2016, started the approval process in 2017, and have everything funded by July of last year. So we're about a year into emerging markets. Now, one of the attractive things about emerging markets was the long-term high expected rate of return, but I think as Ed mentioned at the time, it comes with a high standard deviation. We expect more short-term volatility here. And you'll see over on the right here what we've seen so far this year. In the second quarter, the index was down 8%, year to date down 7%. I think if we're going to update that through yesterday, we're at roughly down 8% year to date. It's been a difficult short-term period. I think if you take a look at the one-year number, which really straddles our experience with emerging markets, we're still up 8%. So we still expect this to be a good long-term investment with a lot of short-term volatility around it. I think as we go through this, the thesis largely around emerging markets was built around the demographics of emerging markets as having a younger population, more people moving into the middle class, more domestic consumption. That thesis still holds true today. What we're experiencing here is currency volatility and a lot of volatility centered around uncertainty around trade and tariffs. So we have long-term demographics that remain sound, short-term trade volatility that is causing a lot of noise. Whether that noise becomes something more serious, I'm not willing to say that yet, but that's something we're taking a look at there. But the long-term demographics and the thesis behind emerging markets remain sound.
Serious is the trade part of it. How serious is the trade part of it if the trade tariffs just go wild and we have a war, per se?
We have a war of words right now that's starting to be manifested in policy.
No. So if it really blows out, how serious is it towards us, for us as investors?
Well, if it leads to an overall rejection of the thesis of globalization, we have to reassess where we're going to be exposed in our equity markets. If the U.S. is an outlier and the rest of the world continues along a globalization trend, we'll have to reassess where we want to be exposed, probably not with the countries that are primarily trading with the United States. But I think right now what we've seen is the currencies have moved dramatically, mm-hmm. and that's based largely on the political narrative and where things might go. The fundamentals have been more resilient, but because we're seeing some pullback in the equity prices, so the company fundamentals remain sound, their equity prices pulled back, and the currencies have pulled back even further, we're starting to see a lot of the volatility there. I think importantly, this is not a monolith. Not all emerging markets are moving in lockstep. So we have a couple really bad scenarios, such as Argentina and Turkey, where we're down in the 40% range year to date, and the currency is down more than that. Then you have bright spots. I mean, in Asia, Taiwan and Thailand are up, you know, high single digits. In Latin America, Colombia and Peru are up in the single digits. In Eastern Europe, Czech Republic is up, Russia's up, so there are bright spots. I think the disparity among those emerging markets is going to be beneficial to active managers, and we run all of our emerging market equity exposure in an active management style. So I think the long-term demographics remain sound. I think the thesis for Contra Costa of why we put money into this remains sound, and we're experiencing a normal level of volatility that we would expect.
Right now.
How much is the currency impacting? I would say the investment's doing good as far as companies producing, making profit, but the current, like, how much is the currency impacting our outcome?
I don't have, Ed, do you have that number? I mean, it's a dominant impact right now.
How much is it impacting?
In other words, like, let's say a company we invested in is doing really well, but because of the currency fluctuation, like, how much does that affect our investment? A little bit, a lot?
The currency is pretty significant. In emerging markets in aggregate, I saw this for the second quarter, emerging markets in aggregate on a hedged basis were down 3%, on an unhedged basis, 8%, so a 5% effect.
Yeah. So in the shorter periods of time, it can be a dominant piece here. So the currency moves are going to swing around a lot, stock prices are going to swing around less, and fundamentals should move even less of that. So.
Can you maybe talk a little bit more about your time horizon for the emerging markets position? So, I mean, a lot of stuff in the news about trade war or currency fluctuations, but I mean, you mentioned on page 10 that there's some tilting around different markets. That's kind of, you mentioned a year there. So is it as though you're reading the news on a daily basis and making adjustments, or are these kind of longer term decisions?
That's a great question. A great leading question. with all the growth assets, we kind of think about things in a minimum time horizon of 5 years. And more realistically, closer to 10 years. These are going to play out over a long period of time. And the reason we think about the 5 to 10 year period is we're starting to get to a business cycle. We are also getting beyond the horizon of the liquidity program. So, you know, 4 years of liquidity program, our 4 years of benefit payments in the liquidity program are taken care of, so the fifth year and beyond tends to be the rest of the portfolio. So when I say tilting and I say 1 year, the tilting was on a strategic basis. The 1 year was we've been in it for a year. So that's our relevant horizon to to date of our experience. But when we start to think about how long do we need to see to say it's working, it's not working, it's a much longer, it's that 5 to 10 year period. This is really, and I mean realistically, 5 to 10 years is about as far as we can possibly forecast. On an actuarial basis, this goes out to 50, 60 years here. And I mean, the growth exposure is really the recognition that we believe in capitalism and we believe in the expansion of capital through private markets and that sort of thing. So it is our longer horizon. The 5 years is a nod to reality to say that I don't think this board is going to give me 20 years to get this deployed and then measure success. So the 5 years starts to get to something we consider to be a meaningful number. All right. Mr. Gordon?
I'm just wondering, the trade war talk and all that is very topical, but it seems to me these markets have been tanking quarter over quarter for quite a while, completely unrelated to the noise. And I'm just wondering, a year ago, did we expect, would we have expected negative 8% year to date at this point, based on what we knew then? Because I'm not asking specifically about you and us, every prognosticator out there, and there's one gentleman with Bloomberg whose name is escaping me, that I watch his periodic quarterly picks, and all of his emerging markets picks have tanked. That is, they're all decidedly negative, beyond his prognostication and his recommendation. So my question is, did we think that then, that it was going to be better, or did we expect this?
Let me frame the. So when you say tanking quarter after quarter, I mean, we took a look at the long-term returns here. We are still positive. Over the past year, we're still high single digits. So the 2018 experience has been sharply negative. 2017 in the past, we've had very good experience, broadly speaking, in the index. But I think in terms of the more important question you wanted to focus on is, like, is this in the range of reality and the range of expectations going in? Well, let's say we have an asset class that we expect to return 10% with a 20% standard deviation. Two-thirds of the time in a given year, we would expect the range of returns to be negative 10 to positive 30. This is pretty much in the range of the standard. I'm going to turn to Ed again. Standard deviation on EM wasn't 20, but it was teens?
Yeah.
Yeah. 15. It's in the range of what we expect, yeah. This level of volatility. It is a volatile asset class because you have that currency exposure, which really can't be hedged in emerging markets efficiently. You do have their dependency on larger markets, so larger markets move, and emerging markets tend to move more up and down. They have a higher beta. But I think in terms of, go back to that underlying thesis of the demographics of what attracted us to us and that kind of that rise of the domestic consumer, that's still the trend we're playing here. That's the trend we're trying to capture here. I think that remains sound. People are, their populations remain young and are getting richer. I think so. When we talk about, things that are tanking, the currencies are going to be impacted the most are ones that are going to be experiencing sanctions or having, they have a major market that they're exporting to that they're engaged in a trade war with. The folks who are producing for a different market or a domestic market are going to be more resilient here. And I think there is that, because there is, it's not a homogenous group, that we do have that heterogeneity within the emerging markets, within the currencies, national policies, currencies, and individual companies. We're going to get quite a bit of variability in there. And a down 8% year to date is it's still in that normal range. Yeah.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Okay.
Well, and the other thing is that a year ago, I mean, we were doing fine with China, and now there's tariffs, right? If that it gets reversed, like tomorrow, oh, no more tariffs, right? Then I can imagine emerging markets is rebounding. It's really hard to.
Yeah, I mean, right? Well, it's a great point. I mean, China tends to dominate a discussion, but China is a large piece of the emerging market basket, but not a majority of the emerging market basket. China's also had a slowdown in their domestic market. So they've got things going on there. Latin America remains strong. If you're not an oil producer right now, you're probably in pretty decent shape. If you're an oil producer with a captive market, you're probably in pretty decent shape. So there's a lot, I mean, it is a big diversified pool with great demographics. That's why we're in it here. We're gonna have a lot of this noise. We knew that noise was going to be there going in. We expect that. We saw that in the standard deviation forecast. This is a normal level of volatility, and we'll treat this as a rebalancing opportunity.
I just pulled up the numbers. Standard deviation that we had for emerging markets was 26.6.
Okay.
So close to 27. So, so that's the highest among all the asset classes. Opportunistic real estate is a close second at 26%. We've done pretty well there. U.S. small cap stocks isn't too far behind at 21.5. So small cap stocks have actually been rallying pretty well this year, even more so than large cap stocks. So this is why we create diversified portfolios. It's hard to know when these things will behave the way they do, but historically that's the way they've done, and that's how we've modeled it. So.
But it feels like a shock after 10 years of low volatility in stock markets, where volatility has been running half of expectations. Now we're running closer to expectations. So, yeah. Feels like a shock to the system, but it is.
Yeah, it's a very volatile environment.
It's, as Ed said, it's the reason we run diversified portfolios, and it's the reason we insulate these so we can not have to trade around things we don't want to trade around. We can rebalance into this and have it there for long-term capital expansion. But, yes?
I want to talk about rebalancing for a moment. Rebalancing, of course, means buying more because it's gone down and we think we're buying on the low side. That's a practical matter. We're buying funds, I assume. I'm not sure I know what's in each one of the funds, but you get funds that get into things like Venezuela, Argentina, Turkey, Iran. Okay, go down the list for all kinds of reasons that the strategy of the fund managers sounds like a good idea. From our point of view, if we were to look at those individually, we might not be enthusiastic about it. You might just talk a little bit about Peru and Colombia are pretty small potatoes in, I think, in this world. It's India, China, Brazil, Argentina, Turkey, et cetera, the big ones. You're still pretty comfortable with all this and a reasonable period of time is going to revert to the mean?
And so I think importantly in there, I don't claim to be an expert on individual markets or currencies. I underwrite asset managers, I underwrite processes, and I underwrite discipline. So I take a look at, and we have separate account or we have commingled funds with the two emerging markets managers, and so maybe just I can touch on what we looked at, what we looked for, and how we monitor them, because it's not what was your line item to Russia? What was your line item to Turkey? It's what process did you say you had in place, whether you had a growth orientation, a value orientation, a safety orientation, a sector or current or a sector or country orientation. Did we sign off on that strategy? Did we sign off on a process that supports that strategy, an investment process? Do the people remain the same? And is your thesis being borne out? Measured relative to an appropriate index. So when I take a look at these individual countries, it's more for personal education. What's going on? What are the drivers here? But what I'm truly underwriting is with TT and with research affiliates, you communicated a process to me. I vetted that process. I vetted the people involved, the controls involved, the discipline involved. Am I seeing that story that you told me, am I seeing that reflected in your portfolio? If so, then my original thesis is still holding true about the manager. And that's where I want to give them time to ride that out over a reasonable cycle, so the 5 years or so. If there's an individual security that is impaired or a country's currency that's really drawing down against the portfolio, that's a chance to have a conversation with the manager. What was your thought going into this? What are you doing to hedge around this? And how are you implementing your process and your discipline in this particular environment? But it's not around, I saw your Brazil holdings, and I'm concerned that we haven't sold this single one yet. Practically speaking, that's not the type of oversight we can reasonably maintain with a smaller team. It's, we understood your process. Do we see that showing up in your portfolio? And are we so comfortable with that?
Oh, very helpful.
And,
thank
you. Very early days yet. We're a year plus into both of these managers. So
it sounds very much like our philosophy with domestic equities, that when we go into a fund, we buy their process. We're saying they have sounds like the same thing.
It's the same approach with every single asset manager we partner with. Have a view of what we're trying to capture. We look at their process, their discipline, their people to capture that. And then all the management decisions are outsourced to those individual managers. Yeah.
Thank you. John, the good news is I understand that Venezuela's inflation rate has leveled off at about 1,000,000% a year. A year. If you're going to buy a Big Mac, it's 100,000 pesos,
right?
Don't supersize it.
Yeah. All right, maybe we'll turn to something that has a little bit brighter current story. And if you turn to slide 12, we'll talk about private credit a little bit. Private credit is a large allocation that the board went into on a dedicated basis in 2016 and approved a relatively significant allocation. Initial talks brought down to 12 and then 10. Still, 10% position is quite significant here. Private credit really seeks to become a lender into markets that had previously been supplied by banks, but when banks pulled back for regulatory reasons or other reasons, this is an alternative supply of loans into the private marketplace here. Conducted a search for a manager or consultant in 2016, made a recommendation to partner with StepStone on a fund of one basis. In 2017, contracting was completed and was funded at the end of last year. The next agenda item really is to have StepStone come in and give an update on what they've accomplished to date in terms of separate accounts and funds that they've put in place for us, how much capital deployed, and what the capital deployment pace is. But that is up and running, and I'm going to go ahead and steal their thunder. It's got about a 9% yield currently in what they've put in place. We are pleased with that. A 9% yield on fixed income assets, on first lien assets, is far superior to what we see in the public with bonds.
What's the total amount of money that we've got in it right
about
now?
About 160 right now.
Okay.
The target is roughly $1 billion.
Okay.
But it's going to take us a while to get there, and they'll talk about the pathway.
That's 9% net? 9% net? 9% return net?
9% gross. So 9% on the individual positions, and then you subtract out the fees, and et cetera.
Same question I think David had. A yield I view as the cash outflow from the principal. Any unrealized depreciation or appreciation in addition to that yield?
Let them touch on it. I have the headline number. They have the decomposition. Let's defer that conversation. That's a great point to bring up with them, though. Yeah. So that one is slowly being ramped up and running.
Good to hear from
you. No, I just wonder what the net yield was.
Let's ask them. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to touch base on here is the risk parity. And after we talk with StepStone and get an update from them, you have a recommendation from Verisk for two risk parity managers. This has been in the asset class or in the asset class targets for a number of years. We've had several discussions about what it is. Is it appropriate for Cicera? If it is appropriate for Cicera, what portfolio does it belong in? So there's recognizing this is a two-year conversation. You're probably all sick of hearing about it. And you'll get to spend a little bit more time with it today. But we did approve it in 2017. We formally transferred that holding or that target allocation to the growth portfolio as a more appropriate home earlier this year. Verisk updated all their recommendations and their data, and they are recommending two managers who will present to the board today. This is the last major moving piece of the growth portfolio build-out. Once this is in place by roughly year end, we'll have all of our buckets in place, and then it's just a matter of bringing up our private market allocations. So this will be the last big board decision around the growth portfolio for the foreseeable future. So I know we have a long agenda, and I know that went probably twice as long as I expected it to, but that's okay. But just to wrap it up here, I mean, the growth portfolio is our big heavy lift portfolio. It is working as expected to date. It does have the insulation that we want from the liquidity portfolio to be able to not trade around it excessively. Our annual reviews are going to give us a chance to test our thesis around all of our allocations, particularly in the public markets, if we see something dramatic happen. If trade wars blow up in a way that we're not expecting, if it becomes much more significant, we can address that on an annual basis so we can catch those the big shifts in relative valuations between our asset classes there. We have made significant progress in our build-out. We are looking at being done with that by year-end. And within the next 3 years, our backward-looking performance numbers should be fully indicative of the new structure. So we have made significant progress. We're on the right path. And you've asked a number of really great questions along the way. But before we move on to the next agenda item, were there any other questions I can address about the growth portfolio?
About that.
All right.
Sounds good.
So since this is our first update from...